Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, who's full from dinner, and along with me, as always, is Mr. Spencer, germ-free and ready to talk about his Independence Williams.
That's a very long title. Thanks.
Hey, but it works. It does, because we're going to be talking about the incredible blockbuster that kind of swept the latter half of the 90s, and that is Independence Day. So stick around as we talk about that, as we get into that film, the cast, the crew, and honestly, its impact in summer blockbusters during that time. So stick around, because it's going to be an interesting conversation.
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got over 200 episodes on our website, filmlosophers.com. You can check us out there. Listen to all of our great episodes. Last week, we had an awesome episode where we talked about epic film dads. And we had on Capeless Crusaders, Amy LaBelle, who was able to join in and bring her knowledge, and I was able to poke fun a little bit because I stole a couple of their choices. Don't shake your head at me, Spencer.
You're very proud, you know, of this, and you shouldn't.
I am extremely proud. Charles Darwin would be proud. You know, survival of the fittest.
All right.
It was a great episode. A lot of fun ensued. If you want to check that out, head over to our website, filmlosophers.com. That's lesson 222. But before you do that, why don't you finish up this episode, okay? Nobody likes people who don't finish their food before they leave the table. Finish this episode, okay? We need you to finish this episode.
Why are you calling people out? What's going on today? Yeah, eat dinner before the podcast, and all of a sudden you're like, you finished. It's like when you started.
It's like when you have your Wheaties before the day starts. Like, oh, right, yeah, I did something right, because everything else is going to go wrong.
What a... Do you want to talk after this? I'm worried about you, man.
Not even close. We got a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about, like we said, the incredible 1996 summer blockbuster, Independence Day. This film has been around for over 20 years, and even though it's been 20 years, this film is still one of the best films that I've seen in the longstanding history of the last three decades. It's a fun, unique sci-fi action thriller kind of film that really kind of set the pace for what would be, to be quite honest, a really awesome, you know, half a decade when it came to film and when it came to movies. So we're going to dig into that. And before we get into the meat and potatoes of everything, Spencer, why don't you give them that official synopsis goodness? I'm all about them food, by the way. So
Yeah, that's great. It's not like I didn't eat dinner at all today or whatever. Strange phenomena surface around the globe. The skies ignite. Terror races through the world's major cities. As these extraordinary events unfold, it becomes clear that a force of incredible magnitude has arrived. Its mission, total annihilation over the 4th of July weekend. Such an American movie. The last hope to stop the destruction is an unlikely group of heroes, united by fate and unimaginable circumstance to save the planet.
Yep. Directed and co-written by Roland Emmerich, the film features an ensemble cast that includes Will Smith, Bill Pullman, Jeff Goldblum, Mary McDonald, Judd Hirsch, Margaret Collin, Randy Quaid, Robert Loggia, James Rebhorn, Harvey Fierstein, not to be confused with the other one, Vivica A. Fox, Harry Connick Jr., and so many more. You had introductions with Adam Baldwin, who, if you're not familiar with Adam Baldwin played Jane in the Firefly series. You had Data. I forget his name, but I'll leave that to Spencer. What's his name?
Oh, I don't remember, actually.
You are a horrible Trekkie.
Oh, shut the heck up. Brent Spiner. That's right. That's
Brent. There you go. See, I knew you were going to get it. This was a great film. A couple pieces of information. According to the producer/co-writer, Dean Devlin, The U.S. military had agreed to support the film by allowing the crew to film at military bases, consulting the actors who have military roles, etc. However, after learning of the Area 51 references in the script, they withdrew their support completely. So that kind of tells you that the government is hiding stuff. The film also holds the records for the most miniature models, most miniature model work to appear in one film. Model shop supervisor Michael Joyce estimated that more miniatures were used for this film than any other two films combined. Due to the advances in digital technology since the film's release, most experts believe this record actually still stands. So that's really cool, because if you've ever taken a look at the introduction on how a lot of the practical effects were used for this film, miniatures were everywhere, which is one of the reasons why this film sincerely is like no other.
It's one of the few things about this film I actually remember from watching it as a kid is watching the special features of the disc.
Yeah.
And it actually talking and showing you how they did it and turning the whole city sideways with miniatures to do plane going through the entire city. It was really cool.
And this is a part of the opportunity where you see practical effects still having a really big impact. Like I said, even today it's still super awesome to see, and the miniatures really do give that realistic effect. The film actually was shot in 72 days, an unusually short period of time for such a big blockbuster. This film had a July 6th release date during the year of 1996, but for the fact that this film was only shot in 72 days, that is astounding. July 3rd release date, that's astounding, because of the fact that you have a film that is pretty much bent on becoming the next big blockbuster for that particular summer. They knew they were going to release it during the summer, so...
Well, you have release it around Independence Day, because it's almost sacrilege not to.
It's we're going to release Independence Day on Halloween. It didn't make sense for any other time other than 4th of July. So, a little bit of the numbers. The film's budget was $75 million. Its domestic opening weekend brought in $50.2 million, and its worldwide gross in total came to just a little over $817 million. I'd say they got their money's worth for that film. As we said, this film's been out for more than two decades, and yes, it's one of those films where it's a little older, and unfortunately we had a very lackluster sequel to it in Independence Day Resurgence. Sadly, kind of one of those black spots in Jeff Goldblum's career, but nevertheless it happened, and directed by Roland Emmerich as well. So it was very interesting to see that they took everything that was good about the first film and kind of did away with it for the second film. So it's almost as disappointing as Pacific Rim 2. But we're not going to talk about Pacific Rim 2 because Spencer will get heated and yell at his microphone. I can see his eyes now. His eyes are turning red, when a bull sees red and it starts getting all heated. Look at, he's flaring his noise.
Okay. No. You're right on this one, 100%. That's the level of bad Independence Day 2 was Pacific Rim 2. And that was sad. Yeah. And
that's very
sad.
So this came out in the summer of 1996. Now, I would say you and I were roughly between 10 and 11, probably 10 years old around that time.
No, I should have been 9.
Yeah, give or take 9 or 10.
Well, it's right after my birthday, so.
This film was one of those films that came out during a time when, honestly, the blockbusters during that time were rolling in. I mean, you had Independence Day, you had a bunch of other films I don't want to get into yet, because that's something I want to talk about later. But this was an age, if you will, where blockbusters were at the height of what it meant to be a blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had several films who were coming out into the theaters. You had a lot of great films with a lot of great actors. They weren't just stockpiling films out of nowhere and just releasing them all at once. They were films that were being released, you know, from different studios, and they were all great films. And so I wanted to ask, Spence, when was the first time you remember seeing Independence Day?
Oh, that's a really hard question for me. because, like, I remember in the 90s, we got, like, a DVD of it at some point, or, like, it must have been late 90s or something, but, like, at a certain point, it was just on constantly in my house. Like, you'd just be in a room, Independence Day is on, you'd, like, go away for a couple hours, you come back, it started up again, and it's still playing. Like, it was, like, our own, like, movie of the house.
For you guys?
I don't remember why we did that, but it was very enjoyable. Sometimes you just come back in and watch it wherever it was at.
And mind you, this was a time when you really didn't have that big of, like, an understanding of, like, okay, well, this movie's going to allow you to, I don't know, make it difficult for parents to say, don't go see it, because it looked like an action movie. Like, during that time, there wasn't a lot of things going on where people were so focused on, oh my gosh, this movie may have this or that. Like, we were seeing these movies when they were being released. Like, nowadays, you have everything and anything that'll tell you, like, hey, just so you know, there's a couple curse words at about 10 minutes in. Someone says damn at about 22 minutes in. Or even worse, you have, like, that family, what is that? Like, for Vudu has, like, that family ability or whatever, where you can watch a movie and it filters out anything bad. So you can watch it with your family. Have you seen that?
I have not. Have you seen that website that tells you if the dog makes it through till the end of the movie?
There's a website for that?
Yep. I think it's called Does the Dog Die?
Are you serious? DoesTheDogDie.com.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But, yeah, it just tells you if dogs make it through the end of the movie. They do an Independence Day, so I believe this movie is a pass for the most part.
What do you mean?
Because Boomer lives.
Oh my gosh.
The most impossible scenario.
Which, yeah, we'll talk about that, the whole Boomer making it at the very last second. Honestly, this was a movie I actually went to the theaters to go see. No surprise. I went to the movie theaters to go see this movie, and it was quite the phenomenon, because of the fact that this movie was the beginning of what would be a very interesting summer for me. And why are you laughing?
Sorry. I was on.
Are you on Does the Dog Die or whatever right now?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I just had to double check.
Uh-huh.
DoesTheDogDie.com.
This was around the time when, you know, all these movies were being dropped, and this was a time where you had the opportunity of going to the theaters and seeing several different kinds of movies during that summer. You had Independence Day about, you know, aliens and spaceships. You had Twister about a natural phenomenon. You had Mission Impossible, which was about espionage. You had, like, The Rock, which was about, like, intrigue and you know, military, you know, coups and whatnot.
Men in Black.
Men in Black. Well, Men in Black was 97.
Oh, is this all just 96?
This is all just 96.
Oh my gosh.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the summer of 96 churned out so many great movies that it's, like, it's insane to even kind of comprehend. Even Disney had their opportunity to, like, throw their lay of the land, and they released The Hunchback of Notre Dame during that summer. You had and I believe 101 Dalmatians, but I'm not too sure. Let me double check on that.
The Glenn Close one?
No, that's November. But yeah, there were so many movies that were coming out during the time, and it was so incredible to see a plethora of different kinds of movies without having so much of the same thing. And I want to get into kind of that in a little bit in terms of, like, the saturation market right now, how the market is currently saturated in terms of, you know, summer blockbusters. But before we do, I want to talk about your expectations. Now, expectations right now, it's kind of, like, a little bit dorky because of the fact that it's like, all right, way back when I first saw. What I want to know is, because it's been a while since you last saw it, correct?
Yeah.
So we recently just saw it, and what I want to know is, What were your thoughts before going into re-seeing this film? Like, what was going through your mind? Obviously, you knew you were going to see Will Smith, and you knew you were going to see Alien. So what else was running through your mind before you saw it?
Really, it was just kind of me wondering what I was going to notice as an adult versus as a kid. Because even going back to just a few other movies I saw as a kid and rewatching them as an adult, I have wildly different opinions and feelings on some of the movies that I've seen. Some of them I used to be like, oh, this movie's great. And then seeing it as an adult, I'm like, this movie is such garbage. Why did I ever like it? I didn't think Independence Day was going to be one of them, because like I feel like I've seen it sometime in the last 10 years. So I knew I liked this movie. But I was just kind of wondering, like, you know, am I going to feel differently about it, you know?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Like, one of the things that first went through my mind was, did it age well? Because it's been a while since I've seen it fully without it having to already been on TV. Or like, because every time, here's the thing. I do not like, and Spencer knows this, I don't like movies that are on TV. I don't like it because they don't ever show everything. And not that I'm like, oh, I need a nip slip or whatever. No, I'm not saying it. I need all that. What I'm saying is, I'm saying I want to get the full scope of what a story is you know, encapsulating. You know, you'll see it at the beginning of the film before it even starts. You know, this film hasn't been edited for time or whatever. And I'm like, no, because then you're telling me that there's something you cut out that the director thought it was important to keep in. And that always bugs me. Like, we did a few episodes a while back on the Oceans trilogy. You remember that?
Yeah.
Do you remember the fight I had with you because you wanted to see the TNT version of those Ocean films? And I'm like, no, Spencer, you don't want that. No. And we still watched it. And I'm like, see, that line's different in the movie because he doesn't say that and it's funnier in the movie. And you're like, oh, well, you know. I'm like, dude, no. No. So for me, I don't like. So I've never really saw it when it's come out. Like, I don't actually own it. This is one of the few movies that I don't
really
own. And I don't own it. And I feel
bad.
I own
a movie you don't? That's so weird.
There you go. I used to have the VHS somewhere, but I don't have it anymore.
I still have that, too. That is in my house right now.
Go ahead. Make me feel bad. but it's like I don't own it, and I feel bad about it, and it's like, this is a movie that I used to love as a kid and I haven't seen or haven't revisited in like 15, 20 years. I'm going to be completely honest. So the expectation coming in was like, I really, really, really hope this fares well, because if it didn't age well, I have no problem being honest on this show and saying, oh my gosh, this movie was a train wreck. Why did I actually like it when I was a kid? And I'll feel bad for saying it. But ultimately, coming out of it, I was like, dude, this movie is still great. This movie still rocks. The cast, the crew, everybody that's in this film, they are hilarious. They are wonderful. And it's such a breath of fresh air to know, first off, that a movie I had picked when I was a kid that I really loved still works well for me as an older adult.
It's always,
I'm like,
great.
Thank you. Thank you, God. Thank you. It wasn't stinky garbage. Like, I don't know what I would have done myself. I would have, like, literally after this episode, after I would have, like, lambasted it, I would have exited the show, walked directly into the shower, fully clothed, and just, like, turned the water on and be like, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Like, total traumatized. But this is one of those elements where it's like, you're right there.
Oh, yeah, I'm fine.
Your eyes kind of glazed over and I'm like, oh, Spence is done. but no, this was one of those movies that I was just praying and hoping that it was still as good as I remembered it. And it was a very like young mindset of like wishing and hoping and dreaming that it was going to actually be well. And thankfully it was. What about you, Spencer? As soon as the movie was done, how did you feel about it?
Besides a few, like, okay, besides one line from Will Smith, I was like, this is a pretty good movie. There was one line where he, like, it's when he's talking to Jasmine, And she's all like, you know, you're not as charming as you think you are. And he's like, yes, I am. And I'm like, that would literally not work with anyone else. It's only because Will Smith is that charismatic that he can carry a line like that. Because anyone else sounds like a jerk when they have that line.
And that's a great point to kind of jump off of, because in terms of talking about the cast, I don't know if there was anybody else other than Will Smith for the role. Like, I don't know if anybody else was, like, considered for it. But he is great in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can I just say that he is absolutely fantastic as Captain Hiller? Like, him being this military person who is trying to get into NASA and wants to just, you know, he has a girlfriend that he lives with, and then she has a kid, and this was one of those parts where you're like, your parents don't really fully understand the full scope of the movie. At no point in time, if you would have showed me any previous footage of Vivica A. Fox or any, you know, photos of her now, at no time whatsoever would I have said, you know what? She once played a stripper. She looks like somebody who played a stripper. I wouldn't have seen that. And this film, I can say, like, when I remember going to the movies and I remember, you know, Harry Connick Jr. is talking to Will Smith and they're in the locker room and he's like, and you know, NASA won't ever let you in if you marry a stripper. And it, like, transitions over the music and you get that scene with Vivica A. Fox. And I remember this hand just reaching over and it's my mom covering my eyes. You don't need to see this. And I was like, what's happening? It's Vivica A. Fox. Like, what the? And it's one of those moments you don't anticipate, but you remember that first time. Everybody remembers that first time they saw Vivica A. Fox stripping. And it was the most PG strip as you could ever imagine.
Yeah, there's like a whole lot of nothing happening. Just because, like, you know,
I think Jamie Lee Curtis had more moves than Vivica A. Fox in this one. Like, I think Jamie Lee Curtis really had more moves than Vivica A. Fox in those striptease moments for her in True Lies in this one. It's just, it was really interesting. But, like, Will Smith, you're right, is such a charismatic and at the time up and coming star, and he's got such personality about him. And his ability to just kind of carry the lead and then have fun in the lead, you know, take control of a situation or a scene. I think it was out of the park. Like, he knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, this is also down. Will Smith coming, like, straight off, like, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. It just ended back in, like, May of 96. So, like,
oh, really?
Yeah. So, like, this is, like, him, like, near the height of his popularity.
Yeah. Well, and you had incredible performances by him throughout the entire thing, but at the same time, you also had the illustrious Jeff Goldblum, who was also already at the height of popularity during the 90s. Like, he was the most talked about thing during the 90s, because of his roles in Jurassic Park and then his roles in the second Jurassic Park, and then this movie. You had Jeff Goldblum coming out of his ears. And to be quite honest, if I, you know, I love his, what's his name in Jurassic Park?
Dr. Ian Malcolm.
Dr. Malcolm. Aside from Dr. Malcolm, I have to say his role in this film is my next best favorite role during his early career. I love it. I love him in this role. The fact that he's like
a cable repairman for some reason.
Well, he ends up working as a cable repairman or something to that effect for a network.
Yeah.
But he's an MIT graduate.
Yeah.
Who goes to work for a network, and then finds this signal in the cable's satellite dishes, and deciphers it and is able to realize that, oh, they're here to do bad things, not good things. And it's great because of the fact that you're like, this is Jeff Goldblum as I would like for him to be, like his dad played by the incredible Judd Hirsch. Like, you cannot go wrong with Judd Hirsch in this film. His role as the dad is not only fitting, but he is funny. Like, his entire shtick throughout this entire thing is side-splitting. to say the least. Not to be cliche, but like I found myself watching the movie and almost spitting out my food or whatever I was drinking at the time, because I hear him say like, "Oh, I'm here to meet the president. If I would have known, I would have wore a tie. I mean, look at me. I look like a schlemiel." And I'm like, "What is that? What? What?" It's like that's Judd Hirsch, and it's funny, and his role is just so sweet because he's a father who cares about his son, and he's a man who is very much wanting to see the people he cares about taken care of. Mind you, his role was like complete garbage in the second film, but driving around in a bus with kids that he kidnaps or something. I don't
remember that movie, and I try to forget as much as I can.
Yeah, same here. Other great roles in that film: Bill Pullman as the president.
Oh, like yes, the president in all movies.
The president. Everybody wanted Bill Pullman. Between Harrison Ford in Air Force One and Bill Pullman in Independence Day, those two, if they ever created like a tag team celebrity like president battle, I would say those two are like the top two. Like they would have to be, because Bill Pullman is so great in this film. Bill Pullman always seems like he's always just Bill Pullman always seems like he's in the sun. Like his eyes always seem like he's like kind of got this.
Okay.
He looks like he's always got his brow furrowed like this, and his eyes, he's always looking like, you know, like this, and he talks like he's in a daycare, because it's always like just above a whisper, and it's like when you hear him in this film and you see him, that quiet strength that he's known for just burst on the scene, and it's a powerful vision of what you would expect from a obviously fictitious president, well, in even some cases literal presidents, but still it's what you would want to see coming from that. And his role is perfect in this film. You know, it's like he is essentially this ex fighter pilot for the military who is now been chosen to become president, and he's lambasted by the media for being this warrior president who doesn't act when he should. And it's all throughout every single media piece that's playing during the time while the president is around. Like you
also
see it in the papers.
Those political pieces were so tame. Like just like hearing them in the background, I was like, there's no way that this is what 90s politics were like.
Well, and you get that one like at the very beginning where that lady, there's like some political conversation happening on TV, and she's like, "Well, we voted in a warrior and we got a wimp." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, okay. Like, sure." I don't know what the political issues were during 1996, but if it was like not having enough Otter Pops, I can see how that could be an issue. Like, it was absurd to me nowadays because of the fact that it's warranted. Like, we hear it all the time, and it's like, oh, yeah. But like back then, I'm like, oh, yeah. And mind you, yes, during the 90s, we had Bill Clinton as president. So maybe a little kind of diversion from the current state of affairs would have been a good idea with Bill Pullman. But either way, like, I think Bill Pullman absolutely nails it as that strong, solid faith type of president who takes action more so than he does just spout off political rants or whatever. Even to the point to where he ends up going into a fighter plane to go and fight alongside everyone else in the film. Like, holy crud, that's not legal. Like, you can't do that. It's like I said, like Harrison Ford all over again in Air Force One. But I have to say, with the mix of cast and crew in this film, even with Harry Connick Jr. in his like 10-minute time frame in that film, because Harry Connick Jr., if there was ever a downside to this film, it's that Harry Connick Jr. was completely underutilized, because
this boy is out of the movie so fast.
He is. It's like, and it's not even funny. Like, how would I have not wanted to see more of the dynamic between Will Smith and Harry Connick Jr.
Yeah.
Like, they just seemed like they were best friends, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be cool. And then you see it, but I'm going to try something. Don't do it. You know me. That's what I'm talking about, or whatever. And he dies, and it's like, oh, I want to see Harry Connick Jr. do more singing, or have him, like, play a piano from heaven or something. I don't know.
Oh, my God. Like, I feel like it would have been nice if he would have died, like, near the final battle, because then you would have had more time with him around or something.
I don't know how much weight this carries, but I have to admit, Randy Quaid plays a really good crazy drunk person. I don't think there's really any other way to put it. He does, and he is like this individual who claims that he once was abducted, and everybody knows it and makes fun of him for it, and he continues on, and he messes up his assignments. He's got a crop dusting plane.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he keeps crop dusting the wrong fields. And, like, it's interesting because you're watching this and you're like, man, Randy Quaid looks like he's so convincing. And then you come to find out that the man actually has problems. And is literally, like, in Canada avoiding tax evasion. Like, you know that this guy's got issues. Several other ones. Like I said, there was Brent Spiner was a really fun addition to the film. You had Harvey Fierstein, who played Marty, Jeff Goldblum's friend from The Network. You had Mary McDonnell, who played Marilyn. You had Robert Loggia, who played the general. There was a great plethora of like people in this film. And they were all great. They were all absolutely wonderful. You had, what's his name? James Rebhorn, who played that like kind of sneaky fiendish, personnel for the president. Who's like, when they're talking about Area 51, he's like, that's not entirely accurate. Like seriously, you know, just jerk bad to the fullest. But it's great. This film was wonderful in terms of cast. And to be quite honest, it was on par as well with its effects, like with the way it came together with the story. The film itself, do you know how long the film is? Oh, it's a little over 2 hours and 25 minutes.
Yeah.
This film does not feel like it's 2 hours and 25 minutes. It feels like
maybe it's 90 minutes.
Huh?
It feels like it's a 90-minute film.
It does. It feels like it's just like it's a simple film that just really, really, really is good, and you're not even noticing it. You're watching all these crazy things happen, and the story flows really well with Will Smith's character and how everybody will eventually intertwine. It's such a good movie.
I also am very impressed with how, like, when the movie starts with its exploding titles, by the way, it is off to the races, like, from the second it's go. Like,
yeah. Independence Day, and then July 2nd. It's like, oh, we're starting now? Okay, we're starting now.
Yeah, no backstory. Let's go. Go. It's amazing.
not even credits or anything, names, just like, boom. Like, oh, I didn't even get a chance to sit down and finish my popcorn. And that's cool. I think it's a unique way to let the audience know this is like story from beginning to end. And it's powerful that way. The practical effects of this film, we've talked about it earlier. The ability for this film to create the sense of realism that it has is incredible. At that point, I hadn't seen unique practical effects like that as of that time since Terminator 2. Which Terminator 2, they used a lot of the same effects, especially like with Sarah Connor being blasted away with, you know, the nuclear. When all that's left is just the skeleton, it's like, I wonder if that's like really what happens, like your fingers lock in or something. And it was a trip, but like you see those types of effects and more in this film, and it's so incredible that you're like, did they really just blast away a whole city? Because it looks like it. But you cannot argue with the fact that they went above and beyond to make a great film, you know? Easily. And that goes to, like, everybody who's on the visual effects team, everybody who made, like, everything possible. Honestly, every aspect of this film, seriously, from model shop supervisor, like we mentioned earlier, Michael Joyce, who mentioned about the miniatures, every single person a part of that team made it so wonderful. I think, honestly, and this is my personal opinion, just because we had mentioned Men in Black comes out the next year.
Right.
If they had used CG or digital effects in this film, I don't think it would have made as much of an impact as it does now. That's how much of a role I feel the practical effects play in this film.
Yeah, I agree with you. Plus, if you take a look at some stills from other movies that did choose to use CGI at the time, they do not look that great, especially anymore. They have not aged well at all.
No, 100%. And that's one of the things, like, you want longevity. You want a film that's going to last. You want a film that's going to take its time to show a story and then last for as long as it can. And this is one of those films where you go back and you're like, oh my gosh, this still looks great. We were laughing about Boomer and the Boomer the dog, and it's, you know, his whole scene where he's like, Vivica Fox is like, Boomer! And she's calling the dog, and the dog's like jumping on hoods and whatever, and the flames are coming. And, like, he comes right as soon as, like, the flames hit. And mind you, it did look a little cheesy, but it was still a great effect. I mean, for the 90s.
It's a good effect, yes. It's an insane premise for a scene.
it's like, oh, my gosh, this dog may bite it. You're just worried at the beginning, like, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no.
Okay, but, like, in all seriousness, all three of those people are dead. Well, two people and a dog. Because,
oh, no doubt, the heat, the amount of heat in that entire thing, doesn't matter how many stones they were stacked on upon by, like, they would have gotten cooked inside and out, mm-hmm. plain and simple. Because if you look, that is a pool of fire that stretches out from the center of that town all the way out. There is nothing that is surviving.
Yeah, especially with an open door and fire. Like, come on now.
And not to mention, aside from the fire, but, like, those scenes where they're having, like, those dog fights with the other alien ships,
mm-hmm.
those were incredible scenes. Like, I would rival those. I would even say, and this is another my controversial opinion, I would prefer these scenes that we see here as opposed to what we saw in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy 1. Like, it just seemed like in this one, there was much more, I don't know, either at stake or the realism or whatever. I mean, mind you, it's fun and whatnot in Guardians of the Galaxy 1. I think I actually like this one better, personally. I don't know. You seem to differ.
I'm on the fence.
And you're leaning into your mic very softly.
I don't know. There's a few times during, like, some of the dogfights with the aircraft where I'm like, I feel like the alien should have already killed you by this point, because, like, you're slowly, like, gliding to the left and they're like, pew, pew, I missed. Like, it's a laser. I feel like it has a rapid fire mode faster than whatever is happening, but
you don't know. That's space technology.
Yeah. Like, I feel like it should be better than,
maybe they load those bad boys. Maybe they get put in the chamber two at a time. You don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That's very true.
Exactly. Exactly.
Eddie.
But I say, like, for me, I think, honestly, the fact is that this scene holds up. Like, the dogfight scenes, they all still hold up for me as
no,
well as, like,
great scenes.
Yeah, they are. They're super great scenes. And watching them, it's like you can't help but get into the movie. And thankfully, because of digital technology and upgrading to, like, DVD and Blu-ray, and 4K resolution.
That's very true.
It's now, like, even better. Like, you're watching it and you're, like, engaged like never before, because you're like, oh my gosh, watching this movie happen. I almost would like to, like, go see it in like an IMAX theater or something. It's crazy.
Well, you might get your chance with the way things are going.
I'm not stepping into a theater anytime soon. I don't know about you.
Oh, I'm not doing that either.
But I want to revisit the conversation we were having before this, and that was the conversation about summer blockbusters and how this movie was exemplified during the 90s, during the year of 1996, as the summer blockbuster of the year. And it's safe to say that that's the truth no matter what. That holds still. It was the quintessential summer blockbuster of 1996. But it's interesting because I was thinking about it earlier, and I'm like, you know, that last half of the decade, because that's the part of the decade I remember the most, from 95 through like 1999, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Those movies during the summer were so much of what you would consider summer blockbusters. You would consider like movies, like we said, like, you know, like Mission Impossible or Twister, you know, movies that really do transcend what you normally consider like your summer blockbusters. It's crazy how many times when you think about blockbusters, people usually think like, all right, well, that was back in like, you know, Jaws. And I was talking to somebody the other day and I was like, they were asking, you know, what was the first blockbuster? And I remember telling them, you know, Jaws, Steven Spielberg's Jaws, way back when, back in 1975, was considered the very first summer blockbuster. And mind you, it was released in the latter half of July 1975. But still, it was one of those ones. I'm sorry, towards the end of June. My bad. It was one of those movies that took the world by storm so much during a time during the year that they coined the phrase summer blockbuster. And I have to admit, like, throughout the whole course of the 90s, I really think the 90s in total kind of encapsulated our generation's greatest decade of blockbusters. Like, not only did we get summer blockbusters, but the actual store Blockbuster was at the height of its popularity.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you go wrong? You know? And it's interesting how you look at that and you're like, all right, let's look at now. And now, you know, most of our
I said now Blockbuster's gone.
Well, yeah, now Blockbuster's gone. Thank you for that heartache. but also, you think about it, and our entire summers are inundated with, and mind you, let me preface this by saying, before I move any forward and, you know, we start getting death threats, I'm a huge fan of Marvel films. I love Marvel to death.
Oh, jeez, here we go.
I love everything. If there's one constant about this show, it is that we appreciate the great storytelling that Marvel and their team have done. With that said, I feel Marvel has kind of created a precedent where they've kind of stolen any opportunity for any true summer blockbuster to come about, because the only thing people are really ready to recognize are Marvel films during the summer. You got films that are coming out constantly, and since, honestly, 2007?
Iron
Man come out?
It was 2008, Iron Man.
Okay, so since like 2008, all the way through up until last year, you know, we've had Marvel blockbusters, one after another, that have just continued to be churned out by the House of Mouse, creating this precedent of people are only coming to expect Marvel films during the summer. And I think that's kind of pushed out a lot of opportunities for individuals to really kind of have that platform, if you will. And mind you, I'm not saying that what Marvel is doing is bad. Not at all. And I'm not saying that, you know, we need to stop, you know, Disney from doing everything that they're doing and blah, 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 blah.
Well, that might not be a bad idea.
Well, yeah, actually, I will definitely get there at that point, because what I'm trying to say is there are, and mind you, there's a ton of directors and filmmakers out there who just, they're not interested in making Marvel films, and that's fine. But they also recognize the fact that Marvel is taking any opportunity for eyes to be on anything else other than Marvel or Disney, mostly Marvel. And to be quite honest, it's becoming summers of superhero films every year. And you look at back then, and mind you, no, we didn't have superhero films every year. But in just that year of 1996, the top five blockbuster films of 1996 are Independence Day, Twister, Mission Impossible, The Rock, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Those could not be five more different types of films than anything else. And nowadays, you got films that just keep being dropped by, like, by Marvel that are essentially one after another after another after another that are essentially all superhero films, which, as I said, is not a bad film. They're not bad movies. It's not a bad studio. But it's like you want to look at it and you want to be like, okay, that's great. We got a bunch of hero movies. We had a lot of great superhero films. And mind you, they've been wonderful. They have created a wonderful picture of the Infinity Saga as it's being held. But to be quite honest, I also want to be able to see what other great films are coming out. I want to know what other great things are getting hyped and hope that that their attention goes to them as well. You know what I'm saying, Spence?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, these last couple of years doing the show with you, I've gotten a good chance to see a whole bunch of, like, variety of movies. And I don't know if I would have seen as many or if it would have just been very... It would have been very superhero slanted had I not been on this podcast. And, like, while it's not, like, a super bad thing, it is kind of a little sad that there's just such an oversaturation of one thing in the market right now.
And that's the superhero movies?
Yeah, yeah.
And mind you, it's not to say that superhero movies are bad.
No,
we're not
reviewing most of them.
Yeah, we love most of them, to be quite honest. We watch them religiously. We have them, you know, Disney Plus definitely has made it accessible to a lot of people to watch as frequently as we can. However, there was a film that came out a couple years ago, I believe 2 years ago. Yeah, it was about 2-3 years ago that... No, it was about 2 years ago that Spence, myself, and our former co-host Chad went to go see, and we had to go see it at like 10 o'clock at night. And do you remember this movie, Spence?
No, I'm not sure which one we're talking about right now.
It was Blindspotting.
Oh yeah, because it was like just flying out of the theaters at the time.
And it was in late July. I believe it was in late July. And we had to go see it at 10 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night because that was the only available showing for it. The film only was in theaters for a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. Wasn't even in major theaters long. And the fact that this movie that dropped during the summertime and because of the amount of push from other films that wanted to be in theaters longer, this film didn't have a lot of time in the actual screenings themselves. This movie got overlooked big time. And I have to admit, Blindspotting has got to be one of the most influential and one of the most vulnerable films I have ever seen in terms of talking about race relations between cops and between people, especially those of the African American community in Northern California and specifically the Bay Area. And how those perceptions are being perceived even now and how people are processing those. You know, and it's crazy how this movie that moved me so much, that moved you so much, I rant about it at least every other day to anybody who's willing to listen. And I tell people about it all the time. And the first thing I say was, have you seen Blindspotting? They're like, what? What's that? And I say, Blindspotting, it's a movie that came out during the summer. Blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, you mean that show on NBC? I'm like, no, not that one. No, not Blindspot. Blindspotting. David Diggs, Rafael Casal. Like, come on. and people are like, I don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. So I tell them about it. I persuade them to watch it. And after they watch it, they're like, oh my gosh, this movie, I can't believe I fell asleep on this movie. This movie was so great. Oh my God, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, can you imagine how many more people are out there who haven't seen this movie? And it's for me, it's like, this movie is powerful. It's like an atomic bomb in DVD form. And when people see it, their lives are changed instantly. But they don't even know it's there. And that's just one film. We have a really close friend to this podcast named Valerie, who does the same thing for films in New York. And she pushes the small films. She pushes the people who and promotes films that aren't really well known and have great diversity and representation. And she sees it and she wants to give that support. And it's great. And I think it's just, it's weird how that's kind of the age we live in, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish it made more sense to me. But unfortunately, it's like the dynamic and the shift we're in. People are more apprehensive to approach the film they don't know, especially if it doesn't have a familiar studio attached to it, or a familiar, you know, star attached to it. And, you know, so much has changed since the 90s. And it's sad to say that. Like, oh my gosh, it's been 20 years since the 90s.
Yeah, let's not talk about that. that does kind of remind me of, like, the original reason why I even saw Blindspotting was because I had MoviePass at the time. Like, and while it had a terrible business model, it actually did get me to see quite a few movies I wouldn't have seen otherwise. And then you're getting into the whole dynamics of, like, you know, movie theater ticket pricing. Like, it's a lot easier to just be like, eh, I'll try this for $5 versus, eh, I'll try this for $15. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the big problems with going to the movies is it's kind of an expensive hobby.
Yeah, you're telling me. But I have to admit, though, this movie, as well as other movies that we've experienced, even though they weren't carried by the Disney name or the Marvel name or the Warner Brothers name or the Paramount name, I don't know, I don't remember who distributed them, or I was unfamiliar with any of their roles in anything else other than David Diggs doing his role in Hamilton as Lafayette. Like, that was the only thing I was familiar with David Diggs. I remember Rafael Casal was a spoken word artist, and David Diggs was a Broadway musical star. But never had I ever seen any of them in a film. So I'm like, all right. And obviously at the time I had not seen Hamilton. I mean, nope. I didn't have money like that. But then it became this wonderful exposure to a world that I was, at the time, not fully aware of, but familiar with somewhat. And it changes your perspective. And that's what a film did. And that's what I'm thinking about, like, with everything else, with other people, with other opportunities. It's like, there are so many things that are happening in terms of in film that are being dropped. Like, take, for instance, this year. The year of 2020. The year of the first half of it being in quarantine due to a pandemic. Due to a global pandemic that has the majority of this country in a shelter-in-place order by the government. This, because of the fact that this situation that we're in currently has a lot of studios pushing back release dates for major films. We got things like Wonder Woman 84... Christopher Nolan's Tenet. You have delayed releases of things from, like, Marvel and from all these major studios. And yet, because of that fear, this silver lining of the situation has kind of peaked itself out by allowing smaller filmmakers to begin taking hold of that box office lead position. Just a couple weeks ago, the top the highest grossing film for that week was a film that is only 29 minutes long, made on a budget of $0, and filmed entirely through Zoom as a 29-minute horror film called Unsubscribe. This movie, 2-3 weeks ago, was the top-grossing film of the country for that week.
Dang.
And it's like a YouTuber made it. And he was like, all right, you know, blah, blah, blah. He even did a YouTube video called How I Made the Top Grossing Film of the Week, you know, with a $0 budget or something like to that effect. And it's incredible. But here's the thing. Would you or I have heard that on any other platform had there been so many, like, inundating ads on every platform about, like, oh, check out this movie coming soon in theaters. Or Disney promoting this or doing that or this or that or the other. Or this company pushing out this, you know, superhero film or that film or this film. Like, we're having an opportunity in this rare moment to give filmmakers a time to shine. And the fact that this film is, this 29-minute homemade film is kind of taking that opportunity back into the hands of independent filmmakers is such a powerful piece of symbolism, because now people can have it back. Filmmakers can take it back. There's no crazy ads that are being blasted all over the place. YouTube is not filled with like $3,000-$4,000 ad campaigns that are plastering like this this superhero film or that superhero film or this or that on every YouTube video. We're getting an opportunity to see what people have been trying to show us for years. And that is summer blockbusters, opportunities for film, opportunities for people to be revealed to them something new is now an opportunity right now. And mind you, most of it is because of the fact that no studio wants to release something without making a good amount of money on it. You take a look at this upcoming weekend, you got Hamilton being dropped on Disney, on Disney Plus. I was looking at it and I'm like, I wanted to see how much was Disney Plus paying for this. Did you know Disney Plus or Disney themselves bought the rights for this Broadway musical to be played and streaming on their platform for over $75 million?
That's not surprising.
Well, no, but the fact that they're going to get paid on this money for God knows how long, for so many days, because of the fact that this is going to be on for a while and people are going to watch it like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. It's just phenomenal. But the fact is that Disney isn't going to make any money on it. They're going to get people who are going to join their service, but no more than already joining it now. Like the majority of the streaming services that people have, Disney Plus is a part of that. But it's like, for right now, this is the time for those independent filmmakers, those opportunities for those people who want to truly find something that is worth quality over quantity during this summer blockbuster season. And you know what? We may not find that next blockbuster in theaters. We may find it on YouTube. We may find it on Vimeo. Vimeo is actually where Unsubscribe is located. Oh. You know, it's a crazy thought. But I circle back around to Independence Day and asking you this question, Spence. Do you feel that we will ever get back to a time where summer blockbusters like Independence Day and movies like Men in Black and movies like Armageddon, those movies, even like movies like The Matrix that are all summer blockbusters during that late 90s, do you think we'll ever get to a time where those kind of movies will get the recognition they deserve?
I don't know.
No, that's an honest question. That's an honest answer. It's not a baiting question. It's just like, because I think it's going to be, personally, I think the dynamic is going to shift for how we view summer blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to move more so not into the territory of like, oh, Paramount's putting out this great summer block, where, or, you know, Legendary Pictures is putting out this incredible picture, or, you know, oh, you know, whatever, Disney, MGM, whoever is putting out it. It's now about, like, you know, finding the quality in a lot of those films and promoting quality over quantity. And I think people like you and I, people like Val Complex out of New York, people like Kristen Lopez out of LA, people who push and promote and discuss and give room for conversation about movies like that. Those are the people like us, who are going to help redefine what a summer blockbuster really is. Because I think now it's coming down to not what the box offices say is a true winner of being a summer blockbuster. Because let's go back to Jaws. When Jaws was released back in 1975, it wasn't the numbers that called Jaws a summer blockbuster. It was the press. And we are the press. And so it is on us, I feel, as members of the press, to redefine and reallocate what truly a summer blockbuster really is.
I thought Jaws was called the summer blockbuster because they had people lining up around the block.
But it was coined by the press. The press put it in the papers.
All right.
I'll let you read up on that. Don't worry. But bottom line is, I feel like us as press, us as people, we have the opportunity who are looking for those types of films, looking for those opportunities, looking for those rare moments of films that really epitomize what we love about movies. We are the ones who are going to be able to find and promote and push what are true blockbusters to the world around us. Plain and simple. Any last thoughts about Independence Day?
If you have not seen it, because it's been out for so long and maybe you're like 15 or whatever, you should definitely check it out and see what a wild time the 90s were.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's still a great film.
And it is. It really is. If you ever get the chance, I don't want to go through too full in detail about how it ends. Obviously, it's been out for a while, so watch it, check it out, get all the goodness out of Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith at his baby face age. And we're not talking like Will Smith and what was that movie that he did with himself?
Oh, Gemini Man.
Gemini Man. He looks a lot better than his CG double, I tell you that much. But yeah, this movie is definitely a movie that really gets the blood pumping. It's a sci-fi action film with aliens and craziness and Harry Connick Jr. and Vivica A. Fox as a stripper. It's got everything that you ever want to see or not really want to see and just is like, what is going on there? But most importantly, this movie sticks with me, and I know it sticks with Spence, as one of those films that just created that sense of what a true summer blockbuster was. It was one of the first great, truly blockbusters of my time that I acknowledge, that I was actually able to say, oh my gosh, this was fantastic. And it's one of those things that I hold close to my heart, probably to the day I die. You know, it's that great of a movie. Not that it's like, oh my gosh, it's the next Ben-Hur. No. But this movie holds a special place within my heart, my family's heart, and we love it. So, obviously, doing a kind of our rating on this. We haven't done a rating in a while, but obviously the film passes for both of us, I'm going to assume, Spence.
How am I going to fail Independence Day?
Did I fail? I think I failed Resurgence.
That doesn't count.
You never know. The film passes for both of us. Spencer, in terms of monocles, how many monocles out of 5 do you give it?
Ooh, okay, this is a bit harder. Okay,
there
so...
There you go.
I'm trying to, like, think of it as, like, you know, a newly released film. At the time, it was a phenomenal movie. I'm going to give this 5. Yeah, because, like...
Really?
It still holds up really well. And I had fun. It made my work day very enjoyable.
Oh my gosh. Okay. You got to see a turtle work. This film is an absolute gem to me. I absolutely love every aspect of it, from its cast to the effects to the idea this film even holds as a summer blockbuster for me. I'm probably going to give this film a 5 monocle out of 5 as well. I would definitely watch this again. Now that rewatching it, I feel comfortable in saying it definitely holds up. And it's one of those movies that I cannot wait to rewatch and to show people that I care about. Like, hey, have you seen Independence Day? Have you been living under a rock? Let's watch Independence Day. So this is definitely one of those types of movies that you should definitely have in your summer film repertoire. And if not, you need to have it in there. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can catch all of our wonderful episodes at filmlosophers.com. All 200 and plus episodes that we have here, including Lesson 223. If you ever want to catch up with us on socials, we're at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. We'd love to hear from you there. And we're excited as the 4th of July is coming up, and even though we are in the midst of a pandemic, that does not mean we cannot celebrate our nation's Independence Day. So as you're out there, be safe, make good choices, don't blow off a finger, and have a good time. So what?
All of that is very good advice, Eddie.
Thank you. I try. So from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.